Before we start with our business of the day, I'd like to request that we observe a moment of silence. One of the parliamentary procedural officers passed on yesterday, and I'd like to observe a moment of silence. Thank you very much. Lorraine Huerta, I'm the chairperson for Standing Committee Education, and welcome everybody. I'm going to give an opportunity to members to introduce yourselves for the record, then I'm going to over to the department, and then all the guests that are in the chamber, please introduce for the record. Thanks. With the department now?
Chair, thank you very much. On the side of the department, give our condolences for the passing of the sports park. It was shocking when you were attending and I saw the picture of the gentleman. And I was so active in the house for those years, so that's part of life. And this shows gravity of life and when God places us, especially in places like this where we are decision makers, important decision makers, we shouldn't waste our time when we need to deal with the issues on the table. I'm Archie Lewis, I'm the DVD for Institution Development and Coordination in the department. I ask my colleagues to introduce themselves.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Sigamani Naika, I'm the Chief Director for Inclusive Education as well.
Good afternoon, I'm the Chief Director of
Districts.
Good afternoon, Oscar Ellis, the Education Secretary.
At the back. Thank you. I have an apology that we have to note, and that is for member Kama, who is not joining us today. And then I believe now that we have some technical issue with the TV. So everybody has the presentation in front of them. So we'll work from the presentation, from the paper presentation. I just want to say that we have received the presentations timeously, okay, and I'm requesting of you from the Education Department that we're not going to go through each slide, that we are sort of going to do a summary. I'm of the opinion that members have prepared themselves for this presentation for today. So members, with your indulgence, I have omitted to introduce our procedural officer, Wasima Hassan Musa. She's not next to me now. She's at the back there. And then on my left, I have Mary Ann Burgess, who is the assistant procedural officer. So thank you, ladies, for your preparations for the Standing Committee meeting. With that said, It's over to the education department. Thank you. Mr. Lewis, can I just pause you there for a while? I just want to check, is that mic on? The middle one. Thank you. Okay, that sounds better. It's going to be four, the presentation is in four parts, is it?
It's one presentation,
but four parts. Okay.
And at that point, I will follow on my colleagues.
Just to add or two. Okay, all right. Then that's okay, we may proceed.
Okay. Dear members of the committee, basically the role of teaching schools in the department is more a support role and an enabling role. In other words, on the top of the table, school sub-director, you see how can we provide an enabling environment in our school so that teaching and learning, meaningful teaching and learning can happen. And doing so contributes to the vision of the department, which is quality education for every child in every classroom, in every school in the province. That is in broad. The structures of the safety support in the entire department rest on one director in head office, that is that the green one in your page, the institutional management governance and planning director. And the sub-director is sitting within that director. And in yellow you can see that the chief director, which Dr. Michael is adding. Then to the bottom and to the right, you'll see the districts. The ones in blue are our four rural districts. And the four to my left, to your left on the page, in orange, those are the four metro districts. In other words, we've got a presence of state schools in each of our districts. Now, the staffing is a district officers. We've also indicated there, you know, that in each district, we've got a state schools coordinator. In other words, the person who's responsible in the district coordinates safety and feeds that safety, the challenges or whatever into head office, into the IMGP director. Then over and above the state schools coordinator, we also have state schools field workers. Now, there are 25 of them, and you can see they are not evenly spread over the district, and the reason for that is that they've been allocated in terms of the number of schools per district, so that we can just also balance that out. So of course in the metro, where the majority of our schools are, about 870 two of our schools are in the metro. We've got the majority of our field workers in the metro. And then if you go to the rural areas, there are less of them. It's not that we don't need them, but it's also a budgetary measure around these things. And then of course in our rural district, we've got after-school program facilitators. There are eight of them. And they are basically there to help schools work in after-school programs and provide that support to teachers.
The next is that each school is supposed to have a school safety committee. And that school safety committee consists of those members. And I'm not going into it, but there you can see all the members that should be in the school safety committee. It's important that you can see that all our stakeholders dealing with safety on whichever sphere of government, they are normally involved, or we encourage them to be, to get involved in our school safety committees. Then your school safety committees are further clustered into geographical units. In other words, where you have got a few schools in close proximity in a geographic area, the school safety committees of those schools can form a cluster safety committee, which is normally chaired or headed by a principal of one of the schools. The next diagram comes from the CSIR document, and it basically says that safety has got three areas which either contribute or help to address safety. There will always be an offender, the red block. There will be a vulnerable victim in the green block. And there will be circumstances where the offender can harm the victim. And when those three areas, you know, converge, that is actually the point where crime happens. Let me give you just one example and I'll step off on the side. If you have something like bullying in our school, there will always be an offender or a learner who will be bullied or harming another learner which will be the vulnerable victim in the green area. Now, the chances of that happening depends on an unsafe environment. In other words, if you have a classroom where there's no teacher, then that creates an unsafe environment where the offender can then do what he or she wants to do towards the victim more easier than under other circumstances. Or if you don't have school guards, school grounds closed during intervals, when there's no teacher parent supervision, and that is where bullying happens easier than under other circumstances. Then you've got role plays in all three areas which are there to either help to deal with the circumstances when it happens. Then I'll say school strategy on the next page, slide. We've got a three-pronged strategy to deal with school safety. And our school safety strategies are more proactive than reactive. We always try to be proactive, but there will be cases where we need to be reactive, and that is in the cases where something already happened, you know, which we couldn't prevent. So we've got environmental programs, and they are linked there. I'm not going into it. There are behavioral programs. In other words, your behavioral problems are focused on both the victim and the perpetrator. Because it's not good enough just to deal with the victim. But we also, as a department, need to look at the perpetrator and how we can correct behavior in the perpetrator to prevent that behavior to continue, and then harm more learners in the school setup. Therefore, there's a lot to deal with systems, and the one of systems is more an integrated, cross-sectoral look at safety and security at schools, where all the other stakeholders will try to get them involved, as in the case of the safety committee just mentioned. The objectives, chair members of the committee are clear. That is what they are trying to do, to enhance safe and secure mechanisms at schools, to deal with the safety management systems,
to facilitate appropriate law enforcement, and that is our liaison work steps, to build a cohesive school community. We shouldn't just look at the school. The learners in the school comes from the community. And what is happening in the community, in the school, is a spillover of your social ills that's happening in society. So we cannot just look at the school and try to deal with it, whilst at the end of the school day we're sending that learner back into an environment where he or she will be faced with similar social ills of drug abuse, other types of abuse, and those kinds of things, and then of course substance abuse. Then, Chair, in terms of crime control, we've got a crime prevention through environmental design, that is CPTD. It's just to look at how can we, in a cohesive manner, dealing with crime, looking at other stakeholders, and then looking also at the minimum security standards, especially at our high-risk schools. Now, it's important to mention that we have in the province about 455 high-risk schools. Those are schools that have been identified, and when Mr. Collins is coming later with the resilience scorecard, we can speak a little bit about our high-risk schools and how we categorize the schools in terms of certain information and influenced by the minimum security standards. Yeah, and let me go to the next slide, Chair. Crime control is just what we are saying, that we've got our safety committees, we've got school safety officers, and there's a 9-point planning process which if members want to hear about it, we can elaborate at a later stage. We also have what holiday security. Now, what we have experienced in the department is that during holidays, especially over the December general holidays, many of our schools were burglars, equipment got stolen, toilets get stripped of whatever is inside the toilet, and our schools are basically left without nothing. And at the beginning of a new school year, it costs the department lots of money. So what we decided in the sub-directorate is those schools, those higher schools, to try and employ security over the festive season at these schools. It comes at a huge cost. But either you decide you invest that cost, or you allow the school to be vandalized, and then in any case, in the new academic year, invest many funds to repair and refurbish the schools. But you're not only doing that, you know, the school year gets destabilized and the school starts on a bad footing. Then of course there's emergency security, that is when something happens at school we need to respond, and that falls under emergency security. And then the next page is just an indication of our four projects as the department from where we are sitting as the Safer Schools project. We are dealing with access control at schools. In other words, we are providing schools with either motorized base to help them to deal effectively with access control. There's a national school safety framework that works together with the occupational health and safety, where we do training to schools and training to teachers. We are doing training on drug testing and search and seizure, and of course collaborating with success when it is necessary to get them into the system, the practicalities thereof. And then we've got the creative and constructive approaches to conflict resolution and peer mediation. That is also to work with learners, especially your learners in leadership positions in schools. You know, in some schools we still have the prefect system, some schools we've got asking us, but those learners we also train so that our learners can also be a line of support at schools where things happen and learners need assistance or appointed call to the manager. youth development, I must stress, you know, if I say we are involved in youth development, then we are involved in youth development for those youth in school, not outside school, you know. It's too large a responsibility to deal with youth in society. So we are dealing with those youth entrusted to us. That's a little bit. The next slide is about the training, health and safety, occupational health and safety training. I'm not going to share a little bit about drug testing and search and seizure, and then about conflict management and mediation that I first explained. Also anti-bullying, or strategies, policy training, and education and advocacy. And the anti-bullying strategy, we work closely with other directors in the department. For example, the specialized education would also assist us not only with the structure, but the support of their parents in the district. Social workers, psychologists, and all those people that we have, they assist when we deal with this. The next slide tells us a little bit about the youth development training program. As I said, it's for our in-school youth and more in our after-school programs, mostly located at our North Center. The youth development scope. That is just an indication of all the different programs that we are engaged with almost all our schools, but as I said, we are more focused on the 455 IRS schools. Beneficiaries of what we are doing in the department. The next slide is not only the learners, the educators, and the principals, in other words, your school community. As I explained earlier, it's important that we also touch the communities from where our learners come. So our programs, we hope, extend beyond the boundaries of the school premises, and that we can reach parents and communities to look at the school differently, to see the school as an asset, see the school as a place where the future of the learners reside, you know. And if we can get communities to protect schools and to take ownership of schools, then we believe that the battle will have won, and that the teaching and learning agenda can continue in our schools. Some of our field workers are also involved in following up, you know, on learner attendance. It's not so effective, and the reason for that is because there are so few of them. We don't have a lot of them. We are relying on the Department of Social Development and their role and involvement in children who are out of school, you know, but the schools, safety school field workers are to some extent helping us to get to those learners out of school and get them back into school. Absenteeism fluency, I've spoken about that. Then just the state schools perform better. And maybe I must ask Austin to go through this one slide for us. We've got a call center while we're speaking for its notes. We've got a call center where five people are almost at manning the call center. There are women also, so manning means women as well. And then we've got one person at the CNC in Bulu who is also assisting with that dog. Paul, can you quickly just take us through that slide? In fact, the two were the steps in the next one. No. Safer school for the safety center.
The safety school center has five persons, many that is staying in the center. three main languages of the Kaap and Gauteng is capable. And then we also rotate on a weekly basis to have one of the four people start sitting at the Transport Management Center, the TMC at Guru. And the reason for that is that at the TMC, we also have all the emergency services, which means that you build flexibility in terms of deployment and also sometimes, more importantly, verification of incidents that happen. And then also, we have schools at which we have school resource officers, and they also call in. And so the call center and the TFC would then pass the referral call to the head office where the rest of the incident. The drafts that we have there, I would say that the call center operates only Mondays to Fridays, and it operates between the hours of 7 and 12 o'clock. And then there is also a voicemail. So if after hours you call in, it will either ask you to leave a message with your details, or it will ask whether you would like to be connected to an emergency service of your choice. And then on the next working day, the call center will then follow up in terms of that. And then the main categories are indicated that members may have seen: abuse, school crime, emergency crises, trauma, cancerism. And so each one of those categories have a subcategory, and they are alive up to the minute in terms of the statistics that we do see from the school. The next slide, which we have here, was just an indication that we gave. That is from 2014 to 2018. Primarily the main categories that I've just spoken to in terms of abuse, but with vandalism, etc. The Safe Schools Call Center is not primarily about the collection of data, but we use the data in terms of analysis of, in terms of analysis with regard to programs that we offer. And so programs that are offered is based on a needs identification with regard to the stats. And then also on a weekly basis, the Safe Schools Call Center will send leads to the district so that they can follow us in terms of the support that needs to be given to the schools. Thank you.
The call center number?
The call center number is 0800-45-46-47. And it's over.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. Interesting stats, you know, those, as Mr. Fuller said, those are calls that come in reporting cases. And for each category, for instance, abuse, there will be subcategories of abuse that's being reported. And the stat there is for the school year, for example, in 2014, there were 481 cases reported of abuse. In 2018, from January to December, there were 727 cases reported of abuse, and so you can go through the steps. Partnerships, share is the next slide. I've spoken about the fact that we don't operate on our own. We deal with all provincial departments, but also spheres of government, local government. And then, of course, community structures like CPFs and whatever community structure is available, we involve those structures in helping to solve the issue of safety of our schools, learners, teachers, but also of our buildings. The next slide gives you some idea of the several roles, and I'm not going into that. Then I will ask Mr. Polis to take us through the resilience scorecard, which is an instrument that we've developed about 2 years ago.
Thank you. Chair, this is a document that we've now been using since last year. And it emanated from a safety summit that was held with regards to identification of schools, classification of schools, with regard to medium, low, and high. Now, we found that the policing had a separate classification criteria. Education used one, the partners to safety used one. So there was confusion in terms of when we speak of a higher school, the colleagues are speaking of other schools.
same question, and you opened in the ISO 31000, which is an international ISO standard in terms of managing of crime control. And in essence, from that particular ISO standard, we developed with the various role players the what is known as the resilience scorecard. And primarily, the resilience scorecard means that we are all now speaking of the same phrase. But that's only the language that we use is the same, so there is no confusion. It is also through this particular scorecard, it's identification of internal and vulnerability, and it's based on risk. Previously, for example, in the video, schools would say they want this, they want that, and the point sometimes is that there is no need, for example, for a particular resource that is there because of the classification of the school. And so in terms of the resilience scorecard, it is underpinned by four pillars. And the first pillar speaks to physical security, and when we speak about physical security, we are speaking primarily, yes, about war bodies. We are talking about carbon blasting strategies, but we are also talking about methodologies, and that would be the implementation of access control policies and other things related to safety. The second pillar speaks to school governance and to leadership. In other words, the vision of the school management and leadership. You have to include your school governing body in terms of the management of the space within the school. The third one speaks about the ownership. The third pillar speaks to the ownership of your space, and that speaks primarily to the parents and to the learners taking ownership. And the last pillar speaks to what is commonly known as we speak about OSA, whole of society approach. And we find that in terms of the whole of society approach, that also equates to the protection of the space. So your community around the school, your neighborhood watch, your community policing forum, your municipality, etc. So all of them play a role in terms of that. And so what we have done then in terms of that is that there is a questionnaire that is linked to us, drop-down responses. And what it does is each one of those pillars will give you a percentage of 100. And so what it gives you the percentage, it tells you what the classification is, but it also comes with what is known as a risk treatment plan. So for example, if the problem lies with school governance, there will be a risk treatment plan in terms of suggestions what to do. But when the system is fully automated, which we are in the process of, the, for example, school governance would not necessarily be a mandate of safe schools, but it would be a mandate of the circuit manager in a particular district. So he or she would then receive an email to say school whatever has a challenge in terms of management, and they would then come alongside and support in that regard. Similarly, with regard to parents and learners, and so in the same way also, when there is a gap identified, it will also refer the person using it for the safety committee to the specific document that they need to consult in terms of putting in whatever the gap is that is in that particular space. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Forrest. Then, Chair, we know that there are structures on different levels in government dealing with the issue of safety, not necessarily school safety only, and the Interministerial Safety Committee, which is the PSG 2 committee, has on a political level an oversight role over safety in the schools and school safety things. Under that, and I'll ask Ms. Conrad to take up with those two charts.
Members of the PSG 2 was the transversal program for all of the items sitting in social justice and provincial strategic goal 2. Initially, it excluded school safety, it excluded jobs. But after a while, the NEC for Education, David Schaefer, at the time, and still is now, realized that school safety, being such an integral part of running a school, required the specific goal phase start getting involved. What I've done is I've sketched a little brief history about it, which send them into the interministerial task committee, which got removed from the normal PhD student committee meeting simply because the conversations became quite confidential in some cases, and not everybody could be included. And then included to that was the length of the conversations actually ended up infringing on the rest of the PhD student committee matters. The next slide, Jerry, but I should give you a history. The minister kept calling people to do presentations and eventually evolved into a committee, which became known as the Ministerial Safety Committee, dealing largely with the anti-gang strategy, and then school safety matters evolved out of that. The MEC chaired the committee itself, which included the MEC for community safety and the HIV PDO models. Other members who attended were community policing forums, the automated demands, the justice department, who dealt with automated demand systems. And I think that was Advocate for Justice Mohammed as well. And then other members, policing forum members. The meeting usually consisted of people who attended, as the Lieutenant General Jala of SAP, Public Prosecution, the NPA, the Regional Commissioner of Correctional Services, the Executive Director of Safety and Security, and then Advocate Mohammed, who is the Regional Head of Justice and Constitutional Development. Emanating from that, a number of additional items came out of that, such as the copying, such as, and in those committees, they were discussing, say, the operational matters, which is the available daily limit. But from a PhD2 perspective, that was where the interministerial committee evolved. In the next iteration, empowering people, the interministerial safety committee has been moved out of the PhD2 space into a different space where community safety sits. So community safety is no longer, it wasn't part of PhD2 initially. They were invited to form part of and they joined in transversely, but now the interministerial committee has been moved out of the empowering people space. They will, I've been told, continue to function as an interministerial safety committee, and our HIV will also change the things of the committee. So that's the update on the interministerial safety committee. As we speak, it is no longer part of the PhD steering committee. It has been moved out. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We also, as the Education Department, have a presence in the cross points where Mr. Mayer is involved. You will take us through two slides.
Good afternoon, Mr. The Appropriate Committee on School Safety meets on a monthly basis, where matters related to specifically school safety is discussed with a range of stakeholders, which includes basically a replication of the provincial joint meeting, so representation from SACS is there, from Correctional Services, from City of Cape Town, from National Intelligence, Police Intelligence, Legal Services of SACS, etc., are all present at a lower level within the School Safety Committee. As I said, the committee meets on a monthly basis, normally immediately after the anti-gang strategy meeting, and so therefore, you know, really call people out once out of their offices. The purpose really is to coordinate the activities of the various stakeholders within the school safety space. To that extent, for example, we have worked very closely with the City of Cape Town in ensuring that we have school resource officers deployed across a number of schools within the province. These school resource officers are employed by the City of Cape Town, and they are then utilized to provide access control as well as internal control within schools in particularly difficult to teach communities. We've also established a school safety operational forum which is one level lower than the club joint school safety committee, and it's really an operational meeting where we will have a meeting with SAPS, City of Cape Town, talking very specifically about deployment in certain areas. So in this, for example, when the assertion seizure in a particular area, operationally that will be done in that particular meeting. The policy or the strategic decision is taken in the provincial joint, in the provincial joint school safety committee. But the operationalization of that happens in the school operational forum. The school self-assessment or the risk assessment tool was approved by the joint school safety committee. And we've had subsequent workshops as to what is the kind of basket of services a school that is indicated as being a red or a high-risk school. What is the kind of services that is afforded to a school that is amber or a school that is green? So, in effect, what it is saying, a school that has a very strong functional security system within the school and has lower numbers of vandalism and community unrest, etc., will not receive the same number of priority visits as what a school in a high-risk area, for example, would be afforded. So it's really a very careful management of the very scarce resources we have within the space as well. We report monthly to the provincial joint meeting where a formal report needs to be submitted. We also have reports from SAPS that is tabled at the meeting in terms of statistics related to crime within schools. We've also activated the watching briefs within this, in the school safety committee. So we monitor any significant cases within schools. So for example, we had an incident of where people went into a school in Khayelitsha, robbed teachers of tablets, etc. That case gets profiled and it gets elevated. So the NPA, who is part of the job joints, also elevate those cases. So if there's any, when that case, for example, goes to court, we will ensure that somebody is present within the court to also issue a statement which talks to the impact of that particular theft from a school. So we had one conviction not so long ago where a perpetrator went into a school, stole equipment from the school, and we then went to court on that particular day, Mr. Pollard, to get a statement of the impact of that theft from that school. It did not allow for learners to be in class because the toilet had to be cut off while we find a plumber to fix the school. So the impact of stealing, for example, a tap at the school has significant impact on the school functioning. And that is what we take to the court. And therefore, the magistrate in that particular case actually gave the full sentencing on that case. I think the perpetrator was then sentenced to 2 years in prison for the stealing of materials from the school. So that impact statement we find has also provided us with quite a bit of leverage when the case actually appears in court. Thank you.
Chair, I want to conclude just by saying our mandate at the education department is teaching and learning in our schools and providing our learners with the best opportunity possible to allow them a platform to become what they can become. It's not our job to fight crime. We are not trained for that. We are not, yeah. We haven't been trained in our training to do that. But on the other hand, we cannot also step aside and say, but that's the job of the police, that's the job of the community. Because it's our learners, because it's our teachers, we need to protect them. And it's actually sad, you know, that for example, for this year, we are spending 32 million rand in this program. And if one could still, and you ask yourself, what can the department do with 32 million rand spent differently on other places? Then it's sad. And it just shows to me again the necessity of an integrated, I almost want to say, attack on safety, crime, criminality, the moral decay in our communities that all of us have to play in order to see how we can address this matter. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you very much for that presentation. Members, you've heard it, you've read it, you've studied the document, and you have prepared yourself to speak to this document and to speak to the department. So I'm giving you an opportunity now to pose or give input. I'm noting Member Bosman and then Member Christian, and Member Said and Member Allen, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chair. My question is with regards to the impact on school safety and policing resources. What is the impact of the shortage of personnel and problems on school safety and the efforts of schools to protect themselves? And then also, is there a standard policy or standard operating procedure that determines how access control is managed at schools? And then I know from the actions that I've had at school in terms of education, that the school in Lavender Hill and the Barna Primary School seems to have some extent of managing access control. Did you know about that? Do we have a list of who the NGOs are that are working in school safety currently in the province? Do we know what they're doing as well?
Thank you. Member Christian, Mr. Lewis, department, I'm taking around, so you're noting? Okay, thanks. Member Christian.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. Being the second term on this education, safety is always a big concern that we have. This debate on numerous occasions. We know that the core function of this department is not safety. We know that. But your learners cannot excel if they're not safe. I read an article, it was earlier this year, where it said in the Western Cape alone, there were 17 stabbings reported in the first term of 2019. And then the people earlier this month in Andover Park, Longford Primary School, said, our school is showered with bullets daily. We need the education department to be demanded for protection from the education department. And then, in Mossel Bay, I've got all the things here, but in Mossel Bay, a child was fist fighting. Somebody pulled out a knife and stabbed the other learner. So, yet again, you have 455 higher schools. Do you have, and is there sufficient access control? Because, and what is access control? If a person comes in with a weapon, can it be picked up? Some people still get into schools with guns, still get in schools with knives. What does this access control entail? And does it prevent people? The other answer was given to me last year was that people throw over the fence the knives and guns but just tell me access control and it's only at the gate. Just give us some briefing on that. Other thing for me that's really important also is that we have all these safety committees and I've jotted it down and we have school resource officers, but yet our learners are not safe. And I know about those five-day programs, I know what happens in the state, but and yet 32 million spent on safety schools is not your job, but how do, with all of these things that you have read, is there improvement? Can we see that our learners are safer now than previously? These plans, is it helping our learners to be safe? Because at the end of the day, like I think Mr. Lewis said, is to get the child to what the child will become. So is that hampering? Safety is all a big thing. And just again, the fencing. I know a lot of money was spent on fencing. I know that alarms and all of those types of things. Are we better off if we look back to last term, last year, is there progress? And with all these communications that we have, and what's in Greece, that you said, and so on, and following the cases, is there progress, as I understand, and these 455 schools, if a learner goes to school in a township where there's crime, is our learner safe? So I will park it there for the next round. Thank you.
Member Sand.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. My questions, I've got various questions, Chair, but I think I'm going to start with just a few for now. The first issue that I'd like to speak to is around the school safety committee. It seems to be multi-pronged. It seems to have various stakeholders involved. But I wanted to get a sense from you guys. Do all schools have these committees? Are these committees functional? What mechanisms does the department have in place to see whether these school safety committees are actually functional? And to then assist the school safety committees when they've got challenges in terms of their functioning. Also, what is the role of the Metro Police and law enforcement when it comes to school safety? How many schools... before getting to that, I want to also ask. We've had an incident, and I raised it. I think it was the first interaction that we had with the department. And as you've spoken about the school in Kalisha, where tablets were stolen, where parents were even involved. What we found happening there was the school governing body, the management of the school, had contacted the department. That has been made from the Equal Education as well, focused on the issue, raised issue in public. That those issues were raised, the safety risks of the school were raised with the department by the SGB. The lack of CCTV cameras was raised. Nothing happened according to the SGB and according to the community. Nothing happened, no action. Afterwards, there was a crime committed. And now we see, I think, it's, the matter has been dealt with, we've got law enforcement involved, prosecuted, everything. But I just wanted to know, what mechanism does the department have in place to oversee that when schools are raising issues and safety risks before something happens, what mechanism is in place to ensure that the relevant officials actually act upon that and provide the resources? And what happens, what are the consequences for officials who are actually lackluster and are not following up? I just wanted to know that. I've noticed that there's not much mention of sexual harassment, sexual violence. Against young women in particular. Could you maybe speak to that? What are the mechanisms in place to prevent it and mitigate against that? Then also, with regards to substance abuse, it was mentioned that substance abuse is quite big at schools, we've got various, it leads to various acts of violence, not only among learners, but also those inside and outside of the school community, whether it's parents or teachers. I know that the Community Safety MEC, I think it was a month ago, spoke about the fact that the building of shebeens near schools needs to come to an end. I wanted to know from you guys, what is the, has the department done an assessment and an audit as to the amount of shabins that are erected near schools, particularly in poor and working class communities? What mechanism does the department have in place to actually engage with government to ensure, or the rest of the departments to ensure that these shabins are not being booked? And then also, and I don't want to, I know that we've taken a stance on the matter, I raised the issue that we raised as well, with regards to the sale of alcohol at schools. Now, I'm not saying that it's happening while learners are at the school or during the school hours, but for fundraising events, so that, you know, I understand. We'll say that the schools need to raise money so that they can get by. But do you not? I mean, how is the department mitigating against the possible risk factors around that particular legislation? Because, say, for example, if you go to poor and working class communities, you'll find a situation where the school is selling alcohol at a fundraising event that applies. That immediately you'll find possible situations with parents, with teachers, with those who are surrounding the school, they indulge in alcohol. As a result of that, people get drunk, they fight, they damage the school. Some may even remain behind, sleep over, stop students in the school. I'm just looking at those, so I want to know what type of mechanisms does the department have in place to deal with the risk factors in that particular legislation around it.
Thank you. Member Allen.
Good afternoon. I'm Paul Dicabert, and I'm glad that you already mentioned that each school should have a safety committee, and we're in front of me reviewing the fact that how many actually have, and I'm also interested to know that how we monitor the actual community that we got. But with regard to the crime control, that you provide a basic minimum security standards, what would be the time around, what would be the turnaround time for logging a query to prevent that it's actually being acted on? I know during the June holiday in Chosun, for example, it was 8 break-ins, if I remember correctly, within a 2-month period. How do we ensure that we are not only adhering to providing these basic security standards, but how can they become more innovative? In the sense that if you go to one particular school, you will see that without it looking like a prison, there is ways and means for us to ensure that someone is unable to actually open that toilet door during the school hours, for example. What kind of coordination is taking place to see what is working at some schools and what are not? Because if we are replacing security features, but then the next time cycles just continues. So what is happening? Being innovative, for example, outside primary school isn't a victim again of a breaking, and so it happens far too many times at the school. So that would be the one. What is the turnaround time for locking that request? And then I'm not sure if I listed, but how many Safe school field workers ongoing, and then for the holiday security, and leads to the master's question, is that what steps are taken to ensure that schools are actually, we're probably not the full group, but what is being done so that we mitigate really that time. And then I'll be interested to also see the criteria with regard to how do you list the school at a higher school, but then just last week, Chair, is on, I found it interesting with regard to the Inter-Ministerial Safety Committee, if we would be privy to any minutes or any further documentation with regard to what was discussed. I see some of the stuff was said here, were often involved, and often confidential, etc. If you guys are willing to provide further information on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is the round. Members, if you want to follow up, please indicate, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, members. I'll quickly just summarize the questions and sign up for some of my colleagues and then we can deal with it. Mr. Bosman, I will respond to your question about sex and the policy will deal with whether there is a software access control and what have you done at Lavana. And perhaps whether we've got a list of NGOs, we can just deal with that. Christians asked about access control, which is the same thing as proposed. Then he also asked whether there is an visible improvement in the attempts and investment that we are doing. Mr. Mayor, being chief of all the schools in the district, can you respond to that one? Also, from there to all schools have safety committees and how functional they are. That's Mr. Stein's question. I would deal with the role of the metal project. Maybe from your sitting in Pro Joints to deal with that one also. If there are safety risks raised by the ACD, you know what happened with the department and whether there are consequent management happening. So maybe from where you are sitting, just to deal with the whole issue of sexual harassment schools and from your point of view, whether there are any activities. The assessment of Supreme Day schools, I will deal with that. Mr. Allen asked about school safety committees, it's already asked. The important thing is the turnaround time is the policy for any query when it is locked at the call center, you know, what is the turnaround time to deal with it? And then the question of innovation. Chairperson, some of the questions we will try to respond, but my own view is that some of the questions was outside our boundaries, you know. Maybe, you know, if you have steps here personally to deal with how they deploy their resources and so on, of course it will be unfair of us as education department to determine whether steps are deployed in the future by the places. What is the fact that we know from reading newspaper material is that we do not have enough staffing for steps in the province, and that could be one reason. So that your limited staff need to be deployed to various pressure points and that schools might be lower down their priority listing. That's an assumption. I'm not saying it is the case, but they will be in a better position to respond to that question. But we do not have enough police in the province. That is one thing. Trying to see what I need to. The assessment of the schools and whether we can influence the legislation. Legislation, we are receiving legislation for implementation. Legislation is the domain of legislatures and parliaments and parliamentarians to help us to put legislation on the table that makes it easier for us as the implementers to implement legislation. All that I know when in the Liquor Act, you know, when anybody applies for a liquor license, there's a public participation process that goes with it. And then everybody, not only the school, everybody has got the right to comment on that on that process and to say yes or no for a license to be issued. Normally what I think is part of the legislation, I'm speaking under correction, that is the prescript in the legislation that says that no shabim will be allowed within a certain radius of the school. So from that point of view, as the school or as the SDP in the school, you know, there will be objections against that the issuing of a license. But then we must also add that many of these shabims operate without a license. And that is where we don't have control, and we will report it. And that is as far as what education can do. We will report that people are selling liquor at a certain point. We will report people are selling drugs at a certain point. And unfortunately, then it's out of our hands, and we just then need to deal with the protection of our learners in that space. Is there any improvement in what we are doing? This process, Mr. Mayor. The improvement is either temporary or there's no improvement. That is my own view. Because the issue of crime and safety at our schools is bigger than just the education enterprise. 2 weeks ago, Stats South Africa issued a report indicating that the unemployment rate in the country stands now at 29%. We know that the economy of the country is in trouble. And as long as we, I believe, in the country do not address those structural issues, we will dealing with the symptoms. Crime is the symptom of something else that creeps into our schools. But if we don't deal with the real issues, we will always be dealing with the symptoms and deal with it in a temporary manner or so, but I don't think it will be sufficient. And that is why I said during my presentation that what the country and what our communities really need is a collective, integrated approach to deal decisively with the criminality and the moral and social decay in our communities, which is spilling over into the school, because the school is the nicest place for whoever to come in, infiltrate, and you've got an audience in the school for the 8 hours, you know, that has been set up there for any criminalities. It's a difficult one, but as education, we need not to lose hope. We must continue with our efforts. Sometimes it will help, sometimes it will not help. But at least we need to go to bed tonight saying that for the day we tried our utmost best and tomorrow we will show them on. Mr. Polis, you should have that.
The impact of, you know, the safety and the utilization of staff resources within our communities is one that has, you know, significant impact across the system. So if we take the Western Cape, for example, we have 26 gang stations, police stations that have been identified as high-risk gang stations within the province. 23 of them, for example, is found within the city, within the lower Cape Town metro area. Those police stations, for example, have high incidences of gang activity associated with them on a regular basis. So from your station like Lavendale or Steenburg, for example, there are always a high number of gang activity within those areas, as well as the Noble Park, Manhattan, etc., etc. So a lot of the police resources are also called to very specifically within those areas. So when we had the initial conversation of providing safe access for EMS ambulances to be able to access certain communities, we identified schools within these guided gang areas that would also act as a safety point where EMS services could gather before going to support, you know, a person within the community that has been injured or, you know, just through a normal case of illness, required an emergency evacuation by an ambulance. So we work closely with SAPS in that regard, and so therefore we have schools in close proximity or within the catchment areas of those gang police stations, where we actually have a regular liaison with SAPS as well as Metro Police in securing those particular schools. But yes, the shortage of police boots on the ground, as the DG of Community Safety often refers to it, is the reality. And hence, we've seen in recent weeks the army being brought into the province as well to assist in those 10 highest areas in the reduction of particularly gang activity within those areas. It's unfortunate. It's a reality that SAPS has resource constraints, but we work with SAPS, we also work with Metro Police quite extensively. And so in areas where we do not necessarily have a strong presence of SAPS, we will rely on the city to support us in providing additional support at our schools. We are also working very closely with Community Safety to try and empower neighborhood watchers to become more active within our communities and to provide access control within our schools as well. And we are at an advanced stage of talking to neighborhood watchers to see how do we assist neighborhood watchers, capacitate them, and utilize their members to provide access control service at our school. And that's a project that we're working jointly with DOCS as well in terms of reducing the impact on our schools. In the case of Obama Primary, for example, the principal and staff of that particular school has worked and is continuing to work very closely with the community. So there's a very strong community presence at the school. And when they, for example, launched the library recently, the community took responsibility of providing security at that particular school. And they even named the library of the learner, for example, that was killed in that area as a remembrance of, you know, her death within that particular community. And it was significant, and the community brought into the school, and therefore they provide, you know, additional safety and security to that particular school. Member Christians, I would love to believe that we are slightly better. We provided an enormous number of schools with additional fencing. And with the new fencing that we provided, children at schools often talk about it as being a bullet protection fence. It's not really, right? It's not really. But learners have regarded as being much safer than the old diamond mesh, for example, that we put in. So we put in the clear view fencing. It does provide a higher level of security to learners on the inside of the school. You know, but we've also had lengths of those new fences removed by persons within the community as well. So areas in Kailicha, for example, we put in a new fence, and within 2 weeks, the fence, almost in its entirety, has been stolen again. You know, and it's not necessarily because of how the community is coming into an area. You know, it is largely within a particular community where that happens. So we, for example, in this year, allocated budget to fence another additional 60 schools, for example. And that program is rolling out as we speak, you know. So we're doing it often, and we're really making an attempt in ensuring a physical security at our school. But you are right, and if I can give you an example, in last year, the communities in Kailicha were at risk because of, you know, people just walking into schools and robbing teachers, etc. We provided an additional 1.5 million to schools to ensure the motorized gates are in place. The cameras are at the gates, for example, to determine who's coming into the facility. To build a security, you know, mesh fencing around the admin block of the school, for example, to secure the administration block of the school is budgeted and then allocated to the schools, which they then, I think it was for each of them, because we provided funding 55 schools, for example, in that project, of 25,000 men to provide, you know, additional access control at schools. But still, remember, when you visit some of our schools, the gates are open. You know, and it's really something that we are trying to address by our safety committees within our communities quite strongly. The alarm system at our school as well, we're investigating a project in the city of Cape Town. We will actually link the schools along to the TMC. So first line response would be from the city of Cape Town, law enforcement or Metro Police, and deploy. And so that project is in its infancy still, but it's definitely one that's on the table. We're looking at working close with the city to provide that monitoring service to the alarms. Because alarm means nothing if it's not monitored. Neither do cameras at the school mean very little if it's not being monitored from a place where there can be a reaction from. And so So there are definite steps with the City of Cape Town to also look at the cameras that are at schools and looking at how we leverage off our Wi-Fi, for example, that we have within our schools to see how we can share the visual information via that particular network as well. The question of the Metro Police is an ongoing project with them. They provide us with the school resource officers. They provide the full basket of services around that particular official. It's one that we work very closely with the Department of Community Safety. Department of Community Safety, for example, has a payment agreement with the city, and there's a process of intergovernmental payment that happens between them. We work very closely with them on a regular basis, and we recently deployed additional school resource officers in the Mitchell Spring area, for example, and Peterhill was the one school, and we're looking at expanding the project into other schools, particularly in the Mitchell Spring area and also in other high-risk areas in the province. The question, there was another question that I wanted to... Holiday safety. We implemented a game changer in the last administration where we encourage learners to participate in activities after school hours. And that after school hours space, for example, we negotiate with neighborhood watches to provide a presence within the school to safeguard, you know, the learners who are playing football or netball, etc., on the school premises or doing drama or art at the school. It is definitely the intention, you know, even in Oscar's program, we'll speak about it, where we have holiday programs at school facilitated by safe schools, for example. And Oscar will perhaps go into a little bit more detail around those holiday programs that we do in that regard as well. In terms of the issue of fencing, school safety committees, Longfay Primary, and the question raised the school as well, it is a huge concern. To the extent we have now looked at the possibility of moving the gates of the school to the other side, because the court directly opposite the school gate is where it is known for significant gang activity. So the idea is to move the gates of the school to the on the other side, so at least to ensure safety entry and exit of teachers and learners to the school. So the interplan also can speak just a little bit more about that. Now that is a physical arrangement, a rearrangement of the city that we have to do in the local area. Thank you.
Chairperson, one point to the two questions that I've been asked is what has been said by the mayor previously. So you cannot have a safe school in an unsafe environment. Can we get about that? When one looks, and Mr. Mayor alluded to the contextualization of crime and violence, and you alluded to the number of gang stations, and when one looks at the 17-18 crime stat that was released, one cannot, you shouldn't be surprised to understand why the school is experiencing also increased levels of crime and violence. Because whatever happens on the weekend or after school, the next morning flows over into the school. I mean, on Thursday we had a problem, for example, in the Oldsworth, where there was a gang fight that took place outside of the school during outside of school hours, but it flowed over into the school because of the fact that parents take sides in terms of their children who inadvertently is also members of gangs. So when one looks at school safety and specifically in the situation, the issue that we are dealing with, we need to look at it in context. We cannot look at school safety in isolation of the safety within the community. Lavana, I want to reiterate the issue about Lavana, and that is linked to the strategy of what Safe School proposed. Safe School said, we talk about a community-orientated problem-solving approach. And we find that at schools where the community is actively involved, that is by your school governing body, by your school safety committee, the problems don't go away, but the parents are more capacitated and empowered to be able to address the issues with, obviously, the other stakeholders present. The question was raised about the issue of the SOP. Yes, there is a standard operating plan in terms of access control.
defense, obviously, in terms of carbon dioxide strategies would be the corona fencing. And Mr. Mayor has alluded to the type of fencing that we are now putting in place to ensure that. And I think Menenberg is a good example of best practice that with the installation of the bisonal fences, or rather your clear view fences, there has been a marked increase in terms of the issue of air passing and access control to that space. So we can use other examples as well. So perimeter fencing. But with perimeter fencing also goes the implementation of access control policies. And so the SGB of the school, who in terms of the SATA, have the responsibility in terms of addressing school safety, need to ensure that those policies are in place, but also through their engagement with the school safety committee to ensure that there is implementation of those. Mr. Mayer referred to, for example, some of maybe Kalicha and some areas where you go to the school, that's open, which means there's no implementation of that access control policy. Then there's also signage that we have in terms of our buildings. Signage which reads, for example, you need to report to the reception the issue of persons not coming up to the premises, things as weapons, substance, and that type of thing. And then, of course, also in terms of the non-systems, which is also part of that discussion. So, yes, there is target marketing strategies, and these are all advocated in our meetings, when we have our school safety committee meetings, we have our cluster committee meetings, and this is also shared with learners, because learners also play a role in terms of the school safety committee and STD with regard to addressing the issue of safety at the school. Then the SACS plays an important role in that regard, and I don't think we're going to be talking about SACS in the absence. But that also, as was indicated by the mayor, there is a challenge for various reasons that we know of. The issue of NGOs within the school. It is part of the standard operating procedure of education department safe schools, specifically with regard to annually when the school needs to review their school safety committees, they have to review their safety plans, they have to review their codes of conduct, and part of that is also that school safety committee, in conjunction with the SCD, needs to take an audit of stakeholders around the school. In other words, who is in the community who can support the school in various types of needs that is there. So there is a list with contact numbers in the school state, in the contingency plan of that particular school. And so that's with regard to the issue of the audit. The question with regard to turnaround, the Safe Schools Call Center obviously will receive a call, yes, and then there are processes that we put in place. We also need to understand that we cannot, if and when a school has now got a gap or need, we cannot just say, right, don't buy it. There is a process in terms of the vehicle that needs to be followed. And the shortest turnaround time is about a week or so in terms of IPS. However, within that period that the school is waiting for that particular infrastructure to be repaired, Safe Schools would then deploy to the school emergency security for that particular period of time, so that the educators and the learners obviously is in a safe space in which they find themselves. Then, the New Delft High School.
If I just give you an example, we built a new high school in Delft and it's now completed, and so now we're in the process of getting an appointing staff, etc., and the school will open in January 2020. And what we found was that the community had indicated that they will burn the school because we need to use local security at the school, for example. And so the cost of employing a private company to now provide security for a new asset, you know, is significant. Because it's not cheap. I mean, if you look at on a 2-week basis, you're probably looking at about 50 to 20,000 rand. That is roughly for 2 persons per day and 2 at night. And so if you roll that over in a big facility like the new Delft High School, for example, you can imagine the numbers that we are going to look at for example, in the safeguarding of that particular facility. So, as Oscar indicated, you know, it's the budget is stretched, and so even though we provided, you know, security for that particular school, you know, it's just continuously expanding in that particular area.
If I may, there's a question that was asked by, I think it was in the state, and it was about the issue about holiday security. Before the holiday period starts, 2 weeks before the holiday period, schools, the district office informs about where you're going to be staying. However, it is the onus of the school principal and the school governing body is a questionnaire, a school safety checklist, a pre-holiday checklist that needs to be completed. And those aspects there relate specifically to safety. For example, has all your valuable equipment been removed from classrooms, has it been locked up in the safe of the school, for example? Can all your windows close? Is your fence intact? Have you spoken to the armed response company about additional patrols? Have you spoken to your community? So those are some of the things on this, what it is, it's a 20-question particular calendar they do, which assists the school and the principal to ensure that at least they have done humanly possible things in terms of addressing that. And then I think it's unfair, Member Sayed, Chairperson, to say that the KHA no action has been taken. All of us sitting here are involved in what happened here. Just to give an example, we need to understand also that the community and the WCD and all the other stakeholders need to work together towards a common purpose. 3-4 weeks ago, we arranged a safety summit for KHA. And a third of the persons who indicated they were going to be present rocked up. There were business plans that was asked in terms of safety measures that had been put in place. None was forthcoming. And so I'm of the view, and just for the House to understand, that on the WCD we have done what we can. However, we also need persons to come forward to assist us in terms of the matters that is raised. I think that's probably enough.
Can I just ask Dr. Knightford to deal with the issue of sexual harassment?
Sure.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. We have an abuse-no protocol, we have a protocol on abuse. And this protocol attempts to provide guidelines to teachers and to social workers and to psychologists in terms of dealing with the issue of abuse and sexual harassment in schools. And, you know, Mr. Lewis has asked me, I just want to make a statement, you know, about the issue of innovation. You know, we had a strategic review on safe schools a short while ago. And what we're trying to understand is our society is changing and our fabric of society is changing that creates the conditions that we are confronted with in the schools. So, you know, let's take a place like Montego. Now, if you do a sociological analysis of the fabric of society, how it has changed in the last 20, 30 years. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand that environment and respond to it and use strategies like the one that Mr. May mentioned about the school that will use technology and the link to TNC. And so there's a group, there's a few schools in Kailisha that we have that will use the TNC, the Transport Management Center, to link with these schools and their alarms to provide a safer environment. So in terms of innovation, we understand that our environment is changing very quickly. We need to have insights into how these societies are changing and what the patterns and trends are in those environments.
So we have to always have a dynamic response in terms of theology. We can't have a one-size-fits-all approach. We have to be clever about what we do. So I think it will take us time to address the challenges, but we are at it all the time.
Is that all the questions exhausted? Yeah. Member Allen? Who asked about the field workers? Was it you?
Yes.
The field workers in our school becomes a leader.
Thank you,
Chair. Okay, do you want to? Mm-hmm.
There are 25 field workers, as I indicated. They're spread over the 8 districts. Over 25,
how does it
there are 15 in the metro. Mm-hmm.
Member Allen.
Thank you, Chair. I think we are all on the same page. And we definitely want to show our students safe. And in that regard, also with regard to adding finding food systems for security mechanisms to mention that yes. It will pass 35 days, but it can take a week for emergency funding to be allocated for your procurement. Would you have an estimate of over the loss? If you take a loss financial year, and you say that there will be X amount of requests, and what that amount that you want to see, what that actual short for would be, so that you can actually quantify that we are short of for security mechanisms. But then I also want to ask, earlier on you mentioned regarding the watching list, where you expose some of the commentators before to get. With regard to CCTV footage that's located at schools, once those are put on camera, what happens to those? Do you have any indication of if that has gone into the watching list and getting deeper information on that one? Especially if people have been pulled and that's when they go to search. Thank you.
Member Christian?
Thank you, Chair. Just a follow-up on one of the questions, on one of the answers. If I must tell a parent that you cannot have a safe school in an unsafe environment, I will never send my child to a school that my child is unsafe. I know about the now and then that you have spillovers from the weekend and all of that, but the question is, and that is basically the question, my child goes to school, is my child safe and protected in that school? And there was a few answers with them, and we talk about moving the gates and permanent fencing and all of this, that kind of stuff. I just want to make sure I'm a normal person in the street and I'm sending my child to school. I cannot accept that we cannot have safe schools in an unsafe environment. It doesn't work that way. I send my child to school, my child into that gate. I want to know that when I fix my school, my child at the end of the day is safe. And I'm talking about, because the majority of our parents is not gangsters, it's not, it's the few that the rotten apples, but a decent lady taking a child to school, I cannot see that we can say that. When my child is school, it's under the guidance of that teacher, that principal, and I want to ensure that my child is safe at the end of the day. So I cannot agree with that, Chair. I just wanted to make that.
Understand?
Chair, thank you. Mine is also a follow-up. I would also then think that I would make a statement and set a point of clarity. When I raised the issue of the specific school in Kailisha, in Nelson Mandela Park in particular, no one of you had a primary school, I did not indicate that the department did not do anything. In fact, the department spoke about it doing something afterwards. That's essentially the problem, it's the action in the aftermath. It's important they must do that. I'm speaking about what is being done before such incidents can happen. And in that particular case, the SGB asked for CCTV cameras to be deployed at the school. No CCTV camera was deployed at the school. That was a specific question. So I just wanted to get clarity in that regard. But that takes us to another, that takes me to another question around CCTV cameras in particular. What criteria is applied by the department in deciding to deploy a CCTV camera at the school? I wanted to know that, because sometimes you might not understand. There may be a school that asks for one and they don't necessarily need one. Or there may be those that need, so I just want to know what are the criteria for that. Then with regards to the working together with neighborhood watches, access control to schools, with neighborhood watches. I see there's an emphasis on neighborhood watches, and I welcome it. It's important. The department and much of the neighborhood watches, community safety works with them as well. I wanted to know, is there a similar emphasis in terms of working with the CPS as well? I wanted to know what's the level of work with CPS when it comes to school safety. Then, with regards to the, there was a point raised earlier about the Delft school and the security guards and the fact that the community wanted local security guards. I wanted to know, because in the foreground of the presentation, there was a discussion and it's consistently being said that, and then the Christians raised this as well, around the community being unsafe, and that regards the school being unsafe. We must not use that as to say no, that's a grim situation. But what I want to indicate is, given that context, given the fact that we've got communities that are unsafe, but that we want communities to also take ownership of ensuring that the schools are safe. I'm not in any sense trying to make excuses for communities who don't want to allow for progress and want their own people to be employed. But I'm saying, what are the criteria in appointing the security personnel at schools? Does the department look at local procurement? Are local companies looked at? Is there a consultation with the community in that regard? Because I feel that it may help if we have the security personnel coming from the ranks of the community. It may just assist in this. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I
just
add something to my question?
Sure.
Just to add, we went to, as a committee, we went to Mondale 2 weeks ago. Because we as a committee wanted to find out, they are very successful in whatever they do. When it comes to sports, academia, they tops. And as a committee, we decided to visit the principal, the school governing body, everybody to there. I just sit there, it was mind-boggling to see the success of the school. And the principal pointed out a couple of things. The fencing that we see from the WCED made a massive difference. And access control. He says, in this school, there must be discipline. There's no discipline, you're out. You know, but it was something that 100% passed. Their school have soccer tournaments. So what is the soccer there? They must 600,000 and then they get... And they plow back into the school because he said, if we excel in sports, we'll attract good learners and academics. Do you understand what I'm saying? So we know what we're talking about because we wanted to understand with this school doing so well, and they also have breakings and they say, okay, we've learned from this, now we must do it this way, must do it that way, let's have a carnival, raise some money, you know, that type of initiative. So we know their schools, and we last year went to Kailicha, that one school, I can't remember, that's doing exceptionally well, even 90% pass rate when it comes to the street. And we also wanted to know, you know, why are you excelling? And they gave it. So there is success stories. And we need to look at where are we striving and how do we link best practice. I even made a statement in the House to send some well wishes to the principal and his teachers and you know that he knows that we took note of that. So there you have visuals playing and you have skillings and shootings, but that school is almost like in a different country when you're in a school.
You won't say that to Jesus Christ. So that is why I'm saying unsafe environment, safe schools, and our children safe. So I just wanted to stress that point. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. So the question therefore is, how do you mirror that? I want to know the school safety committee. When I walk into any school in any district tomorrow, will I find it? And then how do you, shall I say, how do you, or maybe I should ask, who takes the responsibility in the department to take parents on this journey, the safety journey? So how do you communicate to them? And then in terms of your holiday security, also my question is, will I find this in any district school when I walk into a school tomorrow? And in terms of the last financial year, 18-19, do you know what the rand value was of vandalism, your security breaches in schools? What was that rand value? Thank you.
The issue of procurement is perhaps not as simple as what we speak about. There will always be a lag time of any procurement, even if it is emergency procurement, because as a department we need to follow certain restrictions. So, yeah, there will always be a lag time, you know, but we will try to deal with that as swiftly as possible. The issue was raised whether there was a determination of the rand value of the shortfall in order to deal with the security risk at our schools. I'm not sure if Mr. Paul can speak to whether we have an assessment of that nature. Mm. But my own view is, even if we have the rand value of the risk, safety risk attached to schools as a department, we will not be able to respond to it. As we are sitting here at this point in time, as a department we do not have enough money to employ sufficient or enough teachers in the system. We've got a shortage of 2,500 teachers in our system because we do not have money, no one is budgeting for it. And I believe if we can just bring in, if this parliament can, you know, beef up our budget so that we can employ the shortage of 2,500 teachers, the presence of those teachers themselves, just that fact, will help to assist with safety in our schools. So the problem is much bigger than what we know. The CCTV footage, where is available, we provide it to the police. We must remember that most of your CCTV cameras doesn't belong to the education department, it belongs to the city of Cape Town. I know 2 years ago the city of Cape Town applied to us and asked whether they could use our schools premises to put up these cameras, and I know I've responded in the affirmative to that request. Because the argument for us is, if the city's camera, CCTV camera, is on the school setup, surveilling the entire area, at least it's also covering the school environment. Now, I think that discussion is part of the issue that Mr. Mayer mentioned, that we are in negotiation with the city of Cape Town, because nothing comes for free, you know, and they are now also looking for some monetary contribution from the education department to help them, but also to help us, and to help
our communities in the end. The one thing that I want to mention, and it's not an excuse, you know, unfortunately, in our disadvantaged communities, we are still sitting with the apartheid spatial town plan, and the location of some of our schools are so bad. Now, we cannot take that school today and move it to another place. And that is something that we as education will just have to deal with and see how best we can deal with the needs in that school, within that community. I fully agree with Mama Christian that we cannot tell any parent that our schools are unsafe, irrespective of how challenging circumstances are. And maybe Mr. Paulus just meant, technically speaking, we cannot have a safe school and unsafe, but we cannot communicate that to our parents. As an education department, we are there to bring hope to our communities. And how difficult the circumstances are, we always need to give hope to parents who send their children to us as the teachers or to education, who must take care of them for their 8 hours in the day and protect them while they are in our care. So that is just, I fully agree, and I just want to correct all of us perhaps misinterpreted. I've spoken about CCTV cameras and criteria, therefore, it's not ours, therefore, there's no criteria. But we will work with the city to see how we can cover our schools as far as possible. Mr. Mayor, the school safety committees, and the question from the chair, whether they are functional, whether she will get one. And how do we take our parents on the journey? That, to the committee, it's one of our most difficult challenges, to get our parents to take ownership of the school, but I believe more so to take ownership for the future and the education of their own children. Unfortunately, we live in a society where parents sometimes come and almost dump their children in mm-hmm. school.
Mm-hmm.
And even tell the principal and the teachers, my tax money is paying for your salary, so you must look after my children. And that to me is the extent to where the moral decay and the values of our society has fallen. And I repeat myself, you know, it needs a collective effort from all of us to correct those things. And it will take us a generation or two. But I believe that South Africans, all of us, have got a duty to do the right thing in the country. Because if every parent can assist us, then this world and education as an enterprise will become so much easier for us, you know. For teachers to stay as long in our schools. The holiday security at schools, you must remember that all schools do not get holiday security. It's only the higher schools that we allocate holiday security.
Mr. Lewis, can I just interrupt there and ask, in terms of that high risk, how many schools are in that high risk category?
I will hand over to
Chairperson, in as much as 435 schools receive holiday security, some of them receive 24-hour shift and some of them receive 12-hour shift. That decision is made in the cluster based on the risks that is identified. The other schools do not necessarily receive holiday security, however, as part of the WCD strategy in putting in place some of the government strategies like safety gates and house, so those schools receive a specific basket of services which make the premises safe, which means they do not need the additional warm body security at the school, because the school has an alarm, and the alarm is meant to arm response, and
therefore still in negotiation in terms of additional terms with the government. And so it's formed by the property schools per quarter. And sometimes it's less, and sometimes it's more, depending on what the risks were that was achieved during that particular term.
So it depends on the climate in that area at that specific time. Can I then therefore make the assumption that all Manenberg schools are high risk or all Hanover Park schools are high risk? Can I?
Okay. We spoke about the risk resilience too. And the school is still regarded by the community as the safest place when violence breaks out because of the target marketing strategies that has been put in place. And so not all the schools is high risk, because in Manenberg we find that most of the schools are adequately supplied with target marketing strategies, which means we do not have to put in place additional warm body search checks. May I speak to the second issue that was raised?
Yeah, you can.
School safety committee, as we indicated earlier on, Chairperson, is a subcommittee of the school governing body.
Okay.
Which then means if you have, if there is a functional SGB, there to be a functional school safety committee. Because the school safety committee reports directly to the SGB. So how do we know whether we have functional safety committees? We did a audit now at the end of March, and we have between 70% and 80% functional safety committees. So the question is, how does one determine functionality? Functionality in terms of the criteria that we use is that the committee is properly constituted. In other words, it doesn't only consist of the principal and the educators, but it is represented by educators, non-educators, as well as community and the broader society. Another criteria is the fact that there are regular meetings. There is an elected chairperson, and there are meetings, there are minutes, and there's follow-through of minutes. So on that we gauge the functionality of the safety committee. And there's, as I said, between 70% and 80%. Now, we also need to understand that if you walk into a school today, you may not find the safety committee there, because the great percentage of the persons serving on the safety committee are individuals who work. And so yes, you will find the safety officer at the school, you will find the educator who is on the government, on the safety committee, you will also find the non-teaching staff person. And the other members are normally on call. And so primarily the meeting functionality takes place more in the office.
Okay. Can Mr. Lewis, Mr. Meyer?
Thank you, Chairperson. Just two quick questions. There's a question about labour watches and CPFs. We are engaging with them on an ongoing basis. We meet, and DOCS is the facilitating department for that. So DOCS facilitates access to labour watches and to CPFs for us. And so the chief director, for example, in DOCS, will make that available to us when we are working in a particular area. But we do acknowledge that there are some challenges with CPS in some areas that have been infiltrated by different parties, which DOCS is still trying to assist with and resolve as well with those particular. In terms of the local community issue in Delft around security, remember when we build a school, we have a community liaison person that we employ to deal with the contractor and the community. It's normally somebody from within the community that we employ to be the community liaison officer on that particular site. And so definitely within big contracts that we have, for example, the building of a school, there is a requirement within the contract for local labor. You see, and for local subcontractors, you know, to do certain bits of the work. But when we employ a security company, they need to have a certain CIRA rating. Now, in order for a company to have a certain CIRA rating, a security council rating,
they need to undergo certain courses, etc., and their members need to also be accredited in order to have that rating. And so therefore the cost of the security is sometimes a bit higher. But I take the point, and then we'll definitely look at that. We do advertise locally. For example, when we put in emergency security, we do advertise in local newspapers as well for companies to be able to pay. Member Christian, thank you for the accommodation of Monday. I still have on waiting list divisions as well. And I want to just, you know, hand out the member in front of our list, the member's name, spoke about the Zana, dynamic principle, Mondale dynamic principle. But in both cases, it took years of hard work on the staff of that particular school to get to where they are. You know, strong, positive leadership being displayed by both of those principals. For example, we have Spineberg just down the road from Mondale as well, with Mr. Najjar as the principal there, also very strong, and also carried the load very strongly within that particular community. So the appointment also of a strong principal does help. I will convey to Mr. Bridgen, you know, the commendation that you made here for the municipal. Thank you. Sorry, this is the last one. I'm not sure if the committee is aware. We have a program running within our schools around values education. And the program is really targeted at providing values to our learners as a very strong kind of message we want to send out in our schools. And so we have within our schools a values program where every month the school adopts a particular value, and the learners and the teachers of that particular school then deals with that value, all aspects of that value. The intent is that that message goes out into the community as well. And so parents will start hearing the child talking about honesty. They heard that school is a value of the school, and this is what it means. And so we're hoping that that is also going to influence in particularly some of the areas where we do experience a lot of challenges. Of course, we want the support of the committee, when the committee of some of the members, maybe members of the social development committee, to get that particular, you know, department to support us as well in outreach in those particular communities. We of course would definitely welcome that as an opportunity and another mechanism to ensure that there are stronger communities being involved in the process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis?
Chair, we are working with the different stakeholders. And the standing committee in education is one of the most valuable stakeholders which we need to work with. Of course, maybe you will go back and you'll say, well, let's give them a budget and so on. That's always the whole thing. But it's also important, you know, that we know that we need your help, because you've got constituencies, you are getting into schools, you are getting into households. You see what is happening. You hear our cry for people to stand up and to start to take ownership. And therefore, it's important also to be honest when we liaise with you and our stakeholders. The vision of this department is quality education for every child, in every classroom, in every school in the province. If I'm not asked, does it happen, as Mr. Beer, then the answer is no. Doesn't happen. Why do we have situations where parents, if we as an education department tell a parent, but there's place at the school there for your child, we can put the child in there, and the parent says no. The reason? Maybe that school doesn't respond to this vision of the department. So we admit as an education department, there is a lot of work that we need to do, and between myself, HOD, myself, and my 13 year who are responsible for schools and districts, we know that some of our schools are not functioning as it should be. We know that some of our teachers are not contributing and producing what they should be. We are aware that some of our SUBs are part of the problems of our schools because they are destabilizing the education and intervening into the administration and forget that their job is governance. And we are telling you this so that you can also understand
although I know you know it maybe better than what we are. But those are things that we are working on.
Okay. Ms. Conrad?
When dealing with the situation that we find ourselves in terms of school safety, the department is looking at a holistic solution, not just classes to deal with a pet or a dad, although we do put classes on. We realize and recognize that children become hopeless and they become what they become in terms of their behavior as a consequence of a failure that has occurred. And to address that failure, we are looking at the entire child. We are looking at changing the academics, as you are aware through the briefing that I gave you the last time, through bringing in technical schools again, through introducing technical subjects and vocational subjects at ordinary academic schools or public ordinary schools, in expanding the agriculture and arts so that you stick to all the different kinds of learning of the child, so that you develop the kinds of skills that the child can sell. Can give himself a means of income that is not dependent on getting a job with someone. And that's not dependent on achieving an academic standard that they might not be interested in or might not achieve because their interests lie somewhere else. So in terms of the academics, that is what the department is bringing in. In terms of the behavior change, the department is bringing in, as you know, transformed form, which speaks to values, which speaks to growth mindset, which speaks to change mindset, to reignite the passion and understanding of why am I here and our bigger purpose and common purpose. So, and on top of all of that is the need for strong leadership. That cannot be underestimated in any faith, future or form. Because many of our schools lack exactly that strong visionary leadership. And it also means that we need to reconnect teachers with why they became teachers in the first place. In all of that, so you ask the question, are schools safe places? The vast majority of them, yes. Even in the worst of times, the children feel the most safe at school. Where there are incidents, these are anomalies, they're not the norm. But because they get the most airtime, they appear societally as if it is the norm. To address that comes the whole push of our communication of good news stories out into the system. To elevate those Mondales who, as a consequence of the good that they do, get more and more business funding, which obviously supports the growth and development of the school as a consequence. And this is what we do. It's addressing the whole system, not just the first part of the system, which is why the Interministerial Committee was formed in PhD 2 in the first place. That gave rise. It was trying to weave in all of the various stakeholders who could help us deal with the crisis in terms of school safety. It's not just school safety that is a concern for us. It is that child and what that child can become. So it's not just, do I have access to the school? What does access mean? Safe access to the school. We don't have the kind of funding to deal with mental defectives. We can't deal with sexism. We can't deal with man trafficking. And it is true that people do throw weapons over the fence. It passes on through the fence. This does happen. The thing that's going to change that is a behavior change. Because without that behavior change, regardless of how much safety mechanisms we put in place, if someone chooses to attack, they will. So addressing the will to go to violence as the chosen response to a disagreement is where we will find our most success. It is societal change, and that is what we need.
Thank you. I think I just have the last bit of questions that I want to follow up and ask. In terms of the School Safety Committee, as Mr. Apollita has referred to, how many of the SGB persons, I'm saying persons now, are also the school safety committee of all the committees that you spoke to. And then, Mr. Lewis, in terms of disciplinary cases against teachers for transgressions, what is that number now within the WCEG? And then the pilot for the intervention centers, have you, you know, is there results that speaks to the safety issue in schools? Thank you.
Chair, just around Dr. Margaret and respond to the intervention centers. Just around the disciplinary methods around teachers that falls within the HR domain, so I can speak to the chief director for HR and just ask to have that information, or if you wait just for 2 months, then we are coming to the legislature with the annual report, and those steps will be contained in that report. For tonight, and then the school safety committee.
You should explain the question. I got your question, but I don't really understand it.
You're running the pilot now with the intervention center, and you're taking out learners that are posing a risk into the intervention center, continuing with the education on a daily basis. So I just want to know, in terms of the behavioral change that Ms. Conrad has spoken to, what is the results that you have seen so far in terms of the intervention that you do pertaining to those learners at risk?
I think that, the issue of putting children into the intervention center is itself a challenge, because it's at risk behavior. But we have qualified psychologists and social workers and therapists that these children have been exposed to. And while some children pose some serious challenges, we have recorded a lot of progress. And Ms. Conrad talks about an holistic approach. This can be constructed as an holistic approach, because we look at the child within a broader setting, not only in terms of the school, but the family as well. So I think our intervention center has made some significant advances in the last while.
Dr. Nike, if I can just follow up, in terms of the intervention center, how many learners are there now, and what is sort of the range in terms of the grade that are there? And how do you call it now? Reuniting them into mainstream again. Just speak to that in terms of the progress made.
I can supply you with the detailed report with all the statistics.
Okay.
But I think the program, from the report I've seen, the program is doing very well. But I will send you
Member Bosman, and then Mr. Polis still need to answer on my follow up.
Yes, I can say the information available on the WCEED website in terms of the role and functions of the school governing body. It sort of outlines what the governing body must do, and it speaks specifically around developing conduct of schools. And then it goes into managing school property and retaining school facilities, etc. But what guidelines are in place to make sure that once school governing bodies or schools parents elect these SGB members, they actually look at the competencies required for this to further? Because if I'm going to be elected as the person responsible for maintenance and infrastructure, do I know what that entails? And then how do we ensure that we give that kind of guidance and training to schools? Because in my experience, and I understand work in the education sector for the last 7 years now, the schools in affluent areas who
the parents and our support systems in place are able to dedicate additional time to the governing body, and those governing bodies are successful because the parents invest that. And where they don't invest, they've got the capacity to appoint project managers, mm-hmm. staff, etc. But in schools, the parents don't have the additional time where the socioeconomic challenges are great, and where parents sometimes have to travel long distances. They don't have that same approach, and I don't think they get enough support in terms of deciding how the school government bodies are put together. So the question out of that would be, what are the capacity building and leadership development opportunities available for the school governing body members, and what type of sort of welcome kit do they get to say, this is how you establish the governing body, etc. This is what the governing body is going to be doing. And then just a little sort of statement in terms of school leadership, and I like that the response was that it was those two principals at Mondale and at Levana that led the change. And I had a program that looked at connecting classrooms with international NGO, and we had a school leadership conference. And what I found in my experience is that the relationship at schools is quite hierarchical in terms of gatekeeping and stifling innovation. So a lot of principals have been there for 10, 20 years. They haven't done any succession planning in the school because sort of people have been kept in their spaces. So you don't have that innovation. So from an HR perspective, what type of talent identification happens earlier on? Because I think there's this sort of general understanding that to be a principal you have to be old. And that we're seeing is changing now, because you don't necessarily need to be at school for 20 years. Because the skills of a principal is akin to that of a CEO these days. Because you need to be everything and everything to everybody all the time. So maybe just on those two points, Jay.
Whenever you speak about the succession planning, I don't know if you need to be old when principal, if I can recall, I was 33 years old when I became principal of a school of 1,400 children and 62 teachers. Yeah, those were the sort of good days where you can do children what you used to do.
Just around the functionality of your school governing bodies, we elect school governing bodies every 3 years as per SAFA. And it's mandatory that when every third year when a new set of school governing body members come in, that they receive mandatory training. And we've got an outsourced job where we've got outside expertise that take all your school governing bodies through some training. That is the first attempt to deal with or just to orientate and to align. But then the work of the circuit manager in schools is also to identify shortcomings in school governing bodies. And the principal should be the person who alerts the school governing from the circuit manager to say, I think we still need this and that for the school governing body, and then that is being arranged and paid for, and those members receive the requisite training. However, the dawn of democracy brought certain challenges to all of us, and I don't think we have catered enough for all the challenges. That was the opening of schools, you know, where parents can choose where they can send their children. There were some unintended consequences. Is that the parents who have money will send their children to the better or to the best schools. And once that happens, you remove the money that in the past went to, let's say, a parent in Mitchell's Plain. That money that would have gone to a school in Mitchell's Plain moves now to a school somewhere else. Because that parent has money, it's often the case that that parent has got some intellectual capacity as well. So that intellectual capacity of that community
moves out of that community to another location. And the result is that what is left in our poorest of the poor of the poorest communities is, and I say that with respect, but that's the reality, with the parents who have no other option to send their children to a school, and it is those parents which we need to salute who avail themselves to serve our school governing bodies with all the shortcomings. And that's a consequence of democracy, and we hope that we can breed a new generation of parents that can, in a generation from here, fill those gaps. But, yeah.
As well, schools advertise the portfolio, the particular portfolio, and parents apply if they think that they have the capacity to do so. But as Mr. Lewis has indicated, there are four shortcomings, and it is those specific shortcomings that are being addressed with the training that we've done.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Lewis. For your comprehensive presentation, and members, thank you very much for the engagement. I'm sure that we will speak to the safety in schools issue once more, and then we will also invite together with you community safety and SACT, so that we can have a holistic view on this. So I'm sure this committee will call you back again to speak to you. Thank you very much. There are refreshments in the members' lounge, so you are welcome to that. And please drive safely as you disembark from this chamber. Thank you. Mr. Lewis? Thank you. If we can just talk to our administrative staff, and then we'll adjourn from here. Presentation. Any recommendations from this presentation?
So may I ask that we perhaps invite the commercial sector to talk to us specifically about the impact of resource allocation on school, and maybe we can also share some of the solutions that they've identified in terms of how to better police around schools, and what they design less than 3% police into the school holiday.
Okay. You have that? Yeah. Do you ever want to add your own comments safety to that? Do you want to add the department to the provincial SAPs? Add to that recommendation. Can we add them?
Yes.
The community safety.
I'm covered now. I was going to.
Okay. Okay.
Also, Chair, I was
completely this way. I don't know if it's within the same meeting or maybe another session as well, which is social development and Department of Culture and Affairs and Sport.
With regards to the MOD, I'm thinking.
Yes, yes. Or maybe a meeting with both of them, because I don't think there's big issues to have them separate. There's that in one.
And also the department alluded to social development in any case, so we add them to that meeting. Okay.
A separate meeting or another meeting?
No, so add them all together in the same meeting. No? And then just
add
more.
All together so they can speak
yeah,
to each other.
Yeah,
and the department must be part of that.
True,
this particular unit in
the
department must be there.
Yeah.
And
the
MOD
Center. Yeah. So cultural affairs and sport and community safety as a provincial SAPS. And it is social
development
together with WCED, this unit. Yeah.
One more question. Do you want Metro Police there as well, City of Cape Town, because they did allude to them as well in that, that they play a part in the CCTV that is being there, which is also make it...
So the school safety officers might be a school. Yeah.
Would you want that?
Yes.
I'm also now just thinking, because the STB is an integral part of this as well. So some representation of the SGB as well. They have this umbrella body, so maybe that chairperson or two persons of that body to be part of this.
Okay. Yeah.
Then anything else that you have started?
It's the only one thing that has come out is, sorry, Chi, through you. The only one thing that Dr. Naika has alluded to is the detailed report regarding the number of learners at the intervention school, at which grades they are there, and because he couldn't give you the answer on that one. So that's the only one that I picked up. There's nothing else. Everything else was answered. Except for one thing that member Alan asked was not answered on the minutes of the inter-ministerial committee. That's the only thing. Yeah. Okay. So if it deals directly with us, and if it's confidential, then I would ask them whether the committee would have eyes on it. If they could, if they can't, then they would just inform us.
Mm-hmm.
But if they could, it would be strictly confidential to the members of the committee itself.
Mm-hmm. Then if it's confidential, if they can, you know, if we can have access to it in a committee meeting and then just, you know, that just for that period of time. And then give it back if it is in a presentation form. So I have done it before, I think, in some committees.
Chair, let me ask that the document received a submission from people of Cape Town on data submission, pass through that document on the recommendation. They are asking for policy documents and legislation governing the operation of the Provincial Joint Committee and School Safety Board Committee to be made publicly available. Is it my understanding that the presentations here goes up onto the parliamentary website as well? Does it then become public record as well?
We don't put the presentations on the website. We don't put the presentations on the website. What goes onto the website is the agenda of the meeting of today. If they're in the meeting, they would receive the documentation that's before them, unless it's confidential, and it's not. But all documentation, like the presentation, there were copies made available to everyone at the back.
Okay. Moving on. From the recommendation. Shall we deal with the minutes just first, I think? In terms of the minutes, and the minutes is dated the 6th of August, and please be mindful of whether you were present or not, and that you are recorded as such. So that's page 1, and then there's a page 2. Can I have a proposer and a seconder, Member Bosman and Member Christian. Thank you very much. then members, in terms of what was discussed this morning or in the programming committee meeting, that the cluster A, which we fall into, will have a cluster visit on the 27 and 28 of August to Lanesburg. Remember, it was posed in the programming meeting this morning, committee, and I would want to request from this committee, from this members of this committee, whether it would be, because we would have a full day on the Tuesday, which is the 27th, we would then have sort of three-quarters of the day, is that, on the 28th?
We would have the entire day, because the Thursday morning early we would have to depart for.
Okay, so we'd have a full day on the Tuesday, we would have a full day on the Wednesday. We would then have to depart early on Thursday because there is a sitting that day. And I would want to know the possibilities of us, but also it would impact on other committees in this cluster, to then depart from here late on the Monday. So that is my question to you. Is there any reason why we would not be able to leave here late on the Monday afternoon so that we can be there overnight and then start off at 8 in the morning?
If I can just be clarified, so you're saying that we leave here Monday afternoon,
right?
Yes, yeah. Then we the entire day of Tuesday we was there, and then on the Wednesday.
Wednesday also the entire day.
Then we leave Lanesburg.
The Thursday morning early. But that means it's going to be early on Thursday morning.
We'll have to be very early because
yeah.
There's a sitting.
Yeah.
And
there's preparation still
for
the
sitting.
Yeah.
We're
mindful of that.
Extremely early.
Yeah.
Chef, if we leave Lanesburg at 6 a.m. on Thursday,
yeah.
We'll get to Cape Town by 8:30. Just say, figuring it. On the N1 coming into town, so we're going to get traffic. It's a 3-hour drive from Lanesburg coming back, barring some road works in the Montague area.
So we have to leave at 6, you say, if
so we
have
at 6
for the latest.
By 9.
Okay.
I'm happy with that. The social development committee this morning also resolved that it's better to arrive for Monday evening.
Okay. So you have discussed in your committee
as well.
Okay, all right. Member Christian?
I'll come back. I'll come back. I think
For in principle you...
But I
okay.
Have to check my own thing. And
okay.
Then if, so I agree with that, but if I can't, then I'll just excuse
okay.
myself.
Okay, all right. Okay, all right. Okay, okay. Okay, so members, I'm just checking with you, clarifying with you. It would be... Okay, if we leave late on the Monday afternoon, or late in the Monday afternoon, and then return at 6 from there for the Thursday. Okay, in principle we agree on that. Okay, alright. Remember, Alan, you are quite quiet on that.
Okay.
Then, members, in terms of the 23rd, and you all have indicated to Wasima, yay or nay, you are attending the visual arts program in Freedendal, you have that, Miss Water?
No.
Yes, she said no. Okay. So, but the four of us are attending.
I'm not.
Oh.
Not. That's a distance to get to the morning.
Okay. Then the next question is in terms of logistics for the procedural officer to do that now, is in terms of staying over and using the WCPP shuttle.
Is this for Freedendal?
This is for
Freedendal,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We just looked at the closest part just to get members back as well, because the Saturday morning we thought that
when I looked at it, it's in Seedendal. After the event, we will drive to Pikenisdorp and stay there, and then drive in the morning, Saturday morning, early back. Because some members have also got meetings that they're attending that Saturday morning with them. Which is, that is how we're going to arrange it, if it's okay with members. Members, in principle, is that okay with you?
Yeah.
Is that okay with you, members, right? Okay, all right, thank you. Then that takes care of this meeting?
Yes.
Members, in that takes care of this meeting, we shall see each other on the 27th in the chamber as well. Not on the 27th, on the 20th. On the 20th, with the district, the four districts, the outside rural districts, will join us on the 20th. So thank you very much for your availability for this standing committee meeting. This meeting is now adjourned. Thank you to Wasima and to Mary Ann.
Thank you.
Thank you for the transport to Lanesburg.
Are you going to Park? Oh, is that?
I'm there on Friday.
Okay.
Okay, I didn't know
alright, no, then that's fine. Then I know who all I'm going to do accommodation for and who all. Because I'm just going to also get the size of the van that who will be driving so that members are comfortable with the driving.
Mm. Well, I'll need accommodation.
In Lanes.
In Lanes, on the Monday. I'll meet you guys here on Monday.
Departure time in the morning would be the distance to get back to Cape Town would be shorter.
Okay.
Because I wouldn't want members to drive from Friedendale because we were thinking of staying at Lutzville and to drive back from Lutzville back is a bit longer.
Yeah.
And it is a Saturday, you've got other things that you're also doing.
So what are you saying?
We
leave on
Saturday morning.
Early Saturday
morning. Around about 7.
Okay. And are we having one transport?
Yes.
Yes, that's
one
yeah.
transport. Everybody
that's
in
fine.
It. And the reason why I took the news was because that was okay for our lives.
Okay.
And
so we sleep over on the
Friday night.
Only on the
Friday
night.
Night. And
okay.
then we come back and then the next week we do the visitors.
What if yes, that's a cluster visit the next
week. Yeah.
So that one we leave here on the Monday.
Yeah. Late afternoon.
And that's also one transport.
Yes. What we do is we take a big bus shuttle. Really luxury, make sure members are very comfortable because it's a long drive.
Yeah.
And then
I love you, sir. I take that drive every weekend.
that's your choice. That's your question.
So your committee will also be joining us. This will be 4 o'clock of
thank you very much. It's my email address.
Can I send it to you in the morning first thing?
Yeah, sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah,
I'll scan it in and then I'll send it through to you.
Okay.
And then what I'll do is also I'll send you the electronic version of the presentation.
Thank you so much.
So that seems like an
irritation. Yeah. I must say, you guys at the Western Cape Provincial Parliament are much better than
No, we do have a... Don't switch off the lights. I'm still sitting.